War I broke out in the summer of 1914. 1914 was the year in which World War I broke out. There are a few people here my age who remember that. Now, that war was waged on one side by Great Britain, France, and Russia, and on the other side by Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Turkey. What happened? Within 2 years, Germany had won that war. Not alone won it nominally, but won it actually. The German submarines, which were a surprise to the world, had swept all the convoys from the Atlantic Ocean, and Great Britain stood there without ammunition for her soldiers, stood there with 1 week's food supply facing her, and after that, starvation. At that time, the French army had mutinied. They lost 600,000 of the flower of the French youth in the defense of Verdun on the Somme. The Russian army was defecting. They were picking up their toys and going home. They didn't want to play war anymore. They didn't like the Tsar. And the Italian army had collapsed. Now, Germany, not a shot had been fired on the German soil. Not an enemy soldier had crossed the border into Germany. And yet, here was Germany offering England peace terms. They offered England a negotiated peace on what the lawyers call a status quo ante basis. That means, let's call the war off and let everything be as it was before the war started. Well, England in the summer of 1916 was considering that seriously. They had no choice. It was either accepting this negotiated peace that Germany was magnanimously offering them, or going on with the war and being totally defeated. While that was going on, the Zionists in Germany, who represented the Zionists from Eastern Europe, went to the British War Cabinet, and I'm going to be brief because this is a long story, but I have all the documents to prove any statement that I make. If anyone here is curious or doesn't believe what I'm saying is at all possible. The Zionists in London went to the British War Cabinet and they said, look here, you can yet win this war. You don't have to give up. You don't have to accept a negotiated peace offered to you now by Germany. You can win this war if the United States will come in as your ally. The United States was not in the war at that time. We were fresh, we were young, we were rich, we were powerful. And they told England, we will guarantee to bring the United States into the war as your ally, to fight with you on your side, if you will promise us Palestine after you win the war. In other words, they made this deal. We will get the United States into this war as your ally. The price you must pay us is Palestine after you have won the war and defeated Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Turkey. Now, England had as much right to promise Palestine to anybody as the United States would have to promise Japan to Ireland for any reason whatsoever. It's absolutely absurd that Great Britain, that never had any connection or any interest or any right in what is known as Palestine, should offer it as coin of the realm to pay the Zionists for bringing the United States into the war. However, they made that promise in October of 1916. October 1916. And shortly after that, I don't know how many here remember it, the United States, which was almost totally pro-German, because the newspapers here were controlled by Jews, the bankers were Jews, all the media of mass communications in this country were controlled by Jews, and they were pro-German because their people in the majority of cases, came from Germany, and they wanted to see Germany lick the Tsar. The Jews didn't like the Tsar, and they didn't want Russia to win this war. So the German bankers, the German Jews, Kuhn Loew, and the other big banking firms in the United States, refused to finance France or England to the extent of $1. They stood aside and they said, as long as France and England are tied up with Russia, not 1 cent. But they poured money into Germany, they fought with Germany against Russia, trying to lick the Tsarist regime. Now, those same Jews, when they saw the possibility of getting Palestine, they went to England and they made this deal. At that time, everything changed, like the traffic light that changes from red to green, where the newspapers had been all pro-German, where they'd been telling the people the difficulties that Germany was having, fighting Great Britain commercially and in other respects. All of a sudden, the Germans were no good. They were villains. They were Huns. They were shooting Red Cross nurses. They were cutting off babies' hands, and they were no good. Well, shortly after that, Mr. Wilson declared war on Germany. The Zionists in London sent these cables to the United States, to Justice Brandeis, go to work on President Wilson. We're getting from England what we want. Now you go to work, and you go to work on President Wilson and get the United States into the war. And that did happen. That's how the United States got into the war. We had no more interest in it. We had no more right to be in it than we have to be on the moon tonight instead of in this room. Now, the war, World War I, in which the United States participated, had absolutely no reason to be our war. We went in there, we were railroaded into it. If I can be vulgar, we were suckered into that war merely so that the Zionists of the world could obtain Palestine. Now, that is something that the people in the United States have never been told. They never knew why we went into World War I. Now, what happened? After we got into the war, the Zionists went to Great Britain, and they said, well, we performed our part of the agreement. Let's have something in writing that shows that you are going to keep your bargain and give us Palestine after you win the war. Because they didn't know whether the war would last another year or another 10 years. So they started to work out a receipt. The receipt took the form of a letter, and it was worded in very cryptic language so that the world at large wouldn't know what it was all about. And that was called the Balfour Declaration. The Balfour Declaration was merely Great Britain's promise to pay the Zionists what they had agreed upon as a consideration for getting the United States into the war. So this great Balfour Declaration that you hear so much about is just as phony as a $3 bill, and I don't think I can make it more emphatic than that. Now, that is where all the trouble started. The United States was in the war. The United States crushed Germany. We went in there, and it's history. You know what happened. Now, when the war was ended, and the Germans went to Paris, to the Paris Peace Conference in 1919, there were 117 Jews there as a delegation representing the Jews, headed by Bernard Baruch. I was there, I ought to know. Now what happened? The Jews at that peace conference, when they were cutting up Germany and parceling out Europe to all these nations that claimed a right to a certain part of European territory, the Jews said, how about Palestine for us? And they produced, for the first time, to the knowledge of Germans, this Balfour Declaration. So the Germans, for the first time, realized, oh, that was the game. That's why the United States came into the war. And the Germans, for the first time, realized that they were defeated. They suffered this terrific reparations that was slapped onto them because the Zionists wanted Palestine. And they were determined to get it at any cost. Now, that brings us up to another very interesting point. When the Germans realized this, they naturally resented it. Up to that time, the Jews had never been better off in any country in the world than they had been in Germany. You had Mr. Rathenau there, who was maybe 100 times as important in industry and finance as Bernard Baruch in this country. You had Mr. Balin, who owned the two big steamship lines, the North German Lloyd and the Hamburg-American line, thank you. You had Mr. Bleichsröder, who was the banker for the Hohenzollern family. You had the Warburgs in Hamburg, who were the big merchant bankers, the biggest in the world. The Jews were doing very well in Germany. No question about that. Now, the Germans felt, well, that was quite a sellout. It was a sellout that I can best compare. Suppose the United States was at war today with the Soviet Union. And we were winning. And we told the Soviet Union, well, let's quit. We offer you peace terms. Let's forget the whole thing. And all of a sudden, Red China came into the war as an ally of the Soviet Union. And throwing them into the war brought about our defeat, a crushing defeat, with the reparations the likes of which man's imagination cannot encompass. Imagine, then, after that defeat, if we found out that it was the Chinese in this country, our Chinese citizens, who all the time we thought they were loyal citizens working with us, were selling us out to the Soviet Union, and it was through them that Red China was brought into the war against us. How would we feel in the United States against Chinese? I don't think one of them would dare show his face on any street. There wouldn't be lampposts enough convenient to take care of them. Imagine how we would feel. Well, that's how the Germans felt towards these Jews. We've been so nice to them, and from 1905 on, when the first communist revolution in Russia failed and the Jews had to scramble out of Russia, they all went to Germany, and Germany gave them refuge, and they were treated very nicely. And here, they sold Germany down the river for no reason at all, other than they wanted Palestine as a so-called Jewish commonwealth. Now, Nahum Sokolow, all the great leaders, the big names that you read about in connection with Zionism today, they, in 1919, 1920, 21, 22, and 23, they wrote in all their papers, and the press was filled with their statements, that the feeling against the Jews in Germany is due to the fact that they realize that this great defeat was brought about by our intercession and bringing the United States into the war against them. The Jews themselves admitted that. It wasn't that the Germans in 1919 discovered that a glass of Jewish blood tasted better than Coca-Cola or Münchner beer. There was no religious feeling. There was no sentiment against those people merely on account of their religious belief. It was all political. It was economic. It was anything but religious. Nobody cared in Germany whether a Jew went home and pulled down the shades and said Shema Yisrael or Our Father. No one cared in Germany any more than they do in the United States. Now, this feeling that developed later in Germany was due to one thing, that the Germans held the Jews responsible for their crushing defeat for no reason at all, because World War I was started against Germany for no reason for which they were responsible. They were guilty of nothing, only of being successful. They built up a big navy. They built up world trade. You must remember, Germany, at the time of Napoleon, at the time of the French Revolution, what was the German Reich, consisted of 300 small city-states, principalities, dukedoms, and so forth. 300 little separate political entities. And between that time, between the period of between Napoleon and Bismarck, they were consolidated into one state. And within 50 years after that time, they became one of the world's great powers. Their navy was rivaling Great Britain's. They were doing business all over the world. They could undersell anybody and make better products. And what happened? What happened as a result of that? There was a conspiracy between England, France, and Russia that we must slap down Germany, because there isn't one historian in the world that can find a valid reason why those three countries decided to wipe Germany off the map politically. Now, what happened after that? When Germany realized that the Jews were responsible for her defeat, they naturally resented it. But not a hair on the head of any Jew was harmed. Not a single hair. Professor Tanzel of Georgetown University, who had access to all the secret papers of the State Department, wrote in his book and quoted from a State Department document written by Hugo Schoenfeld, a Jew who Cordell Hull sent to Europe in 1933 to investigate the so-called camps of political prisoners. And he wrote back that he found them in very fine condition. They were in excellent shape. Everybody treated well. And they were filled with communists. Well, a lot of them were Jews, because the Jews happened to be maybe 98% of the communists in Europe at that time. And there were some priests there and ministers, labor leaders, masons, and others who had international affiliations. Now, the Jews sort of tried to keep the lid on this fact. They didn't want the world to really understand that they had sold out Germany and that the Germans resented that. So they did take appropriate action against them. They, shall I say, discriminated against them wherever they could. They shunned them, the same as we would the Chinese or the Negroes or the Catholics or anyone in this country that sold us out to an enemy and brought about our defeat. Now, after a while, the Jews of the world didn't know what to do. So they called a meeting in Amsterdam. Jews from every country in the world attended in July 1933. And they said to Germany, "You fire Hitler and you put every Jew back into his former position, whether he was a communist, no matter what he was. You can't treat us that way. And we, the Jews of the world, are calling upon you and serving this ultimatum upon you." Well, the Germans told them, you can imagine. So what did they do? They broke up. And Samuel Untermeyer, if the name means anything to people here, you want to ask the question? Well, I don't want to go by what they were called. We're now using English words, and what they were called in Germany is not very material, but they were communists, because in 1917, the communists took over Germany for a few days. Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht and a group of Jews in Germany took over the government for 3 days. In fact, when the Kaiser ended the war, he fled to Holland because he thought the communists were going to take over Germany as they did Russia, and that he was going to meet the same fate that the Tsar did in Russia. So he left and went to Holland for safety and for security. Now, at that time, when the communist threat in Germany was quashed, it was quiet, the Jews were working still, trying to get back into their former status, and the Germans fought them in every way they could without hurting a hair on anyone's head. The same as one group, the prohibitionists, fought the people who were interested in liquor, and they didn't fight one another with pistols. They did it every way they could. Well, that's the way they were fighting the Jews in Germany. And at that time, mind you, there were 80 to 90 million Germans, and there were only 460,000 Jews. Less than one-half of 1% of the population of Germany were Jews. And yet, they controlled all the press, they controlled most of the economy, because they had come in and with cheap money, you know, the way the mark was devalued, they bought up practically everything. Well, in 1933, when Germany refused to surrender, mind you, to the World Conference of Jews in Amsterdam, they broke up, and Mr. Untermeyer came back to the United States, who was the head of the American delegation and the president of the whole conference, and he went from the steamer to ABC and made a radio broadcast throughout the United States in which he said, "The Jews of the world now declare a holy war against Germany. We are now engaged in a sacred conflict against the Germans, and we are going to starve them into surrender. We are going to use a worldwide boycott against them that will destroy them because they are dependent upon their export business." And it is a fact that two-thirds of Germany's food supply had to be imported. And it could only be imported with the proceeds of what they exported, their labor. So if Germany could not export, two-thirds of Germany's population would have to starve. There just was not enough food for more than one-third of a population. Now, in this declaration, which I have here, it was printed on a whole page, in the New York Times on August 7th, 1933, Mr. Samuel Untermeyer boldly stated that this economic boycott is our means of self-defense. President Roosevelt has advocated its use in the NRA, which some of you may remember, where everybody was to be boycotted unless they followed the rules laid down by the New Deal, which of course was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court at that time. Nevertheless, the Jews of the world declared a boycott against Germany, and it was so effective that you couldn't find one thing in any store anywhere in the world with the word "Made in Germany" on it. In fact, an executive of the Woolworth Company told me that they had to dump millions of dollars worth of crockery and dishes into the river, that their stores were boycotted. If anyone came in and found a dish marked "Made in Germany," they were picketed with signs, "Hitler, murderer," and so forth, and like something like these sit-ins that are taking place in the South. R.H. Macy, which is controlled by a family called Strauss, who are also happen to be Jews, a woman found stockings there, which came from Chemnitz, marked "Made in Germany." Well, they were cotton stockings. They may have been there 20 years, because since I've been observing women's legs in the last 20 years, I haven't seen a pair with cotton stockings on them. So I saw Macy boycotted with hundreds of people walking around with signs, "Murderers" and "Hitlerites" and so forth. Now, up to that time, not one hair of any Jew had been hurt in Germany. There was no suffering, there was no starvation, there was no murder, there was nothing. Now, that, naturally, the Germans said, "Why, who are these people to declare a boycott against us and throw all our people out of work and our industries come to a standstill? Who are they to do that to us?" And they naturally resented it. Certainly they painted swastikas on stores owned by Jews. Why should a German go in and give their money to a storekeeper who is part of a boycott, who is going to starve Germany into surrender into the Jews of the world, who are going to dictate who their premier or chancellor was to be? Well, it was ridiculous. That continued for some time. And it wasn't until 1938 when a young Jew from Poland walked into the German embassy in Paris and shot one of the officials that the Germans really started to get rough with the Jews in Germany. And you found the men breaking windows and having street fights and so forth. Now, for anyone to say that, I don't like to use the word anti-Semitism because it's meaningless, but it means something to you still, so I'll have to use it. The only reason that there was any feeling in Germany against Jews was that they were responsible, number one, for World War I, number two, for this worldwide boycott, and number three, did I say for World War I, they were responsible for the boycott, and also for World War II, because after this thing got out of hand, it was absolutely necessary for the Jews and Germany to lock horns in a war to see which one was going to survive. In the meanwhile, I had lived in Germany, and I knew that the Germans had decided Europe is going to be Christian or communist. There is no in-between. It's going to be Christian or it's going to be communist. And the Germans decided we're going to keep it Christian if possible. And they started to rearm. And their intention was, by that time, the United States had recognized the Soviet Union, which they did in November 1933. The Soviet Union was becoming very powerful, and Germany realized, well, our turn is going to come soon unless we are strong. The same as we in this country are saying today, our turn is going to come soon unless we're strong, and our government is spending $83 or $84 billion of your money for defense, they say. Defense against who? Defense against 40,000 little Jews in Moscow that took over Russia and then, in their devious ways, took over control of many other governments of the world. Now, for this country to now be on the verge of a third world war from which we cannot emerge a victor is something that staggers my imagination. I know that nuclear bombs are measured in terms of megatons. A megaton is a term used to describe 1 million tons of TNT. 1 million tons of TNT is a megaton. Now, our nuclear bombs had a capacity of 10 megatons, 10 million tons of TNT. That was when they were first developed, 5 or 6 years ago. Now, the nuclear bombs that are being developed have a capacity of 200 megatons. And God knows how many megatons the nuclear bombs that the Soviet Union has to have a capacity. So, what do we face now? If we trigger a world war that may develop into a nuclear war, humanity is finished. And why will it take place? It will take place because Act 3, the curtain goes up on Act 3. Act 1 was World War I. Act 2 was World War II. Act 3 is going to be World War III. The Jews of the world, the Zionists, and their co-religionists everywhere are determined that they are going to again use the United States to help them permanently retain Palestine as their foothold for their world government. Now that is just as true as I'm standing here, because not alone have I read it, but many here have read it, and it's known all over the world. Now, what are we going to do? This life you save may be your sons, your boys, may be on their way to that war tonight and you don't know it any more than you knew that in 1916 in London, the Zionists made a deal with the British War Cabinet to send your sons to war in Europe. Did you know it at that time? Not a person in the United States knew it. You weren't permitted to know it. Who knew it? President Wilson knew it. Colonel House knew it. Others knew it. Did I know it? I had a pretty good idea of what was going on. I was liaison to Henry Morgenthau Sr. in the 1912 campaign when President Wilson was elected. And there was talk around the office there. I was confidential man to Henry Morgenthau Sr., who was chairman of the Finance Committee, and I was liaison between him and Rollo Wells, the treasurer. So I sat in these meetings with President Wilson at the head of the table and all the others, and I heard them drum into President Wilson's brain the graduated income tax and what has become the Federal Reserve, and also indoctrinate him with the Zionist movement. And Justice Brandeis and President Wilson were just as close as the two fingers on this hand, and President Woodrow Wilson was just as incompetent when it came to determining what was going on as a newborn baby. And that's how they got us into World War I, why we all slept. Now at this moment, they may be planning this World War III, in which we don't stand a chance, even if they don't use nuclear bombs. How can the United States, about 5% of the world, go out and fight 80 to 90% of the world on their home ground? How can we do it? Send our boys over there to be slaughtered? For what? So the Jews can have Palestine as their commonwealth? They fooled you so much that you don't know whether you're coming or going. Now, any judge, when he charges a jury, says, gentlemen, any witness that you find has told a single lie, you can disregard all his testimony. That is correct. I don't know from what states you come, but in New York State, that is the way the judge addresses a jury. If that witness said one lie, disregard his testimony. Now, what are the facts? The Jews, I call them Jews to you because they're known as Jews. I don't call them Jews. I refer to them as so-called Jews because I know what they are. If Jesus was a Jew, there isn't a Jew in the world today. And if those people are Jews, certainly our Lord and Savior was not one of them. And I can prove that. Now what happened? The Eastern European Jews, who form 92% of the world's population, of those people who call themselves Jews, were originally Khazars. They were a warlike tribe that lived deep in the heart of Asia. And they were so warlike that even the Asiatics drove them out of Asia into Eastern Europe. And to reduce this, so you don't get too confused about the history of Eastern Europe, they set up this big Khazar kingdom, 800,000 square miles. Only there was no Russia, there were no other countries, and the Khazar kingdom was the biggest country in all Europe. So big and so powerful that when the other monarchs wanted to go to war, the Khazars would loan them 40,000 soldiers. That's how big and powerful they were. Now, they were phallic worshippers, which is filthy. I don't want to go into the details of that now. It was their religion, the way it was the religion of many other pagans or barbarians elsewhere in the world. Now, the king became so disgusted with the degeneracy of his kingdom that he decided to adopt a so-called monotheistic faith, either Christianity, Islam, the Muslim faith, or what is known today as Judaism, really Talmudism.
Mr. Friedman's address will be continued on the second recording, along with a question and answer period between Mr. Friedman and the audience.
Now, the king became so disgusted with the degeneracy of his kingdom that he decided to adopt a so-called monotheistic faith, either Christianity, Islam, the Muslim faith, or what is known today as Judaism, really Talmudism. So, like spinning a top, he said, eeny, meeny, miny, moe, and he picked out so-called Judaism. And that became the state religion, and he sent down to the Talmudic schools of Tel Aviv and Sura, and brought up thousands of these rabbis with their teachings, and he opened up synagogues and schools in his kingdom of 800,000 people, 800,000 square miles, and maybe 10 to 20 million people, and they became what we call Jews. There wasn't one of them that ever had an ancestor that ever put a toe in the Holy Land, not alone in Old Testament history, but back to time, the beginning of time. Not one of them. And yet they come to the Christians and they ask us to support their armed insurrection in Palestine by saying, well, you want to certainly help repatriate God's chosen people to their promised land, their ancestral homeland. It's your Christian duty. We gave you one of our boys as your Lord and Savior. You now go to church on Sunday and kneel, and you worship a Jew, and we're Jews. Well, they were pagan Khazars who were converted just the same as the Irish. And it's just as ridiculous to call them people of the Holy Land as it would be. There are 54 million Chinese Muslims. 54 million. And Muhammad only died in 620 A.D., so in that time, 54 million Chinese have accepted Islam as their religious belief. Now imagine in China, 2,000 miles away from Arabia, where the city of Mecca is located, where Muhammad was born, imagine if the 54 million Chinese called themselves Arabs. Imagine. Why, you'd say they're lunatics. Any man that believes that those 54 million Chinese are Arabs must be crazy. All they did was adopt as a religious faith a belief that had its origin in Mecca, in Arabia. The same as the Irish. When the Irish became Christians, nobody dumped them in the ocean and imported from the Holy Land a new crop of inhabitants that were Christians, that Christian flesh and blood. They weren't different people. They were the same people, but they had accepted Christianity as their religious faith. Now these pagans, these Asiatics, these Turco-Finns, they were a Mongoloid race who were forced out of Asia into Eastern Europe. They likewise, because their king took the faith, this Talmudic faith, they had no choice, just the same as in Spain. If the king was Catholic, everybody had to be a Catholic. If not, you had to get out of Spain. So everybody, they lived on the land, just like the trees and the bushes. A human being belonged to the land under their feudal system. So they all became what we call today Jews. Now imagine how silly it was for the Christians, for the great Christian countries of the world to say, we're going to use our power, our prestige, to help repatriate God's chosen people to their ancestral homeland, their promised land. Now, could there be a bigger lie than that? Could there be a bigger lie than that? And because they control the newspapers, the magazines, the radio, the television, the book publishing business, they have the ministers in the pulpits, they have the politicians on the soapboxes talking the same language. So naturally, you'd believe black is white if you heard it often enough. You wouldn't call black black anymore. You'd start to call black white, and nobody could blame you. Now, that is one of the great lies that is the foundation of all the misery that has befallen the world. Because after two wars fought in Europe, World War I and World War II, if it wasn't possible for them to live in peace and harmony with the people in Europe, like their brethren are living in the United States, what were the two wars fought for? Did they have to, like you, flush the toilet because they couldn't get along? Did they have to say, well, we're going back to our homeland, and you Christians help us? I can't understand yet how the Christians in Europe could have been that dumb, because every theologian, every history teacher knew the things that I'm telling you. But they naturally bribed them, shut them up with money, stuffed their mouth with money, and now I don't care whether you know all this or not. It doesn't make any difference to me whether you know all these facts or not. But it does make a big difference to me. I've got, in my family, boys that will have to be in the next war. And I don't want them to go and fight and die like they died in Korea, like they died in Japan, like they died all over the world. For what? To help crooks hold on to what they stole from innocent people who had been in peaceful possession of that land, those farms, those homes, for hundreds and maybe thousands of years? Is that why the United States must go to war? Because the Democratic Party wants New York State, the electoral votes, Illinois, the electoral votes, in Pennsylvania, the electoral votes, which are controlled by the Zionists and their co-religionists, the balance of power. In New York City, there are 400,000 members of the Liberal Party, all Zionists and their co-religionists. And New York State went for Kennedy by 400,000 votes. Now, I don't blame Mr. Kennedy. I'm fond of Mr. Kennedy. I think he's a great man. I think he can really pull us out of this trouble if we get the facts to him. And I believe he knows a great deal more than his appointments indicate he knows. He's playing with the enemy. Like when you go fishing, you've got to play with the fish. Let him out and pull him in, and let him out and pull him in. But knowing Mr. Kennedy's father and how well informed he is on this whole subject and how close Kennedy is to his father, I don't think Mr. Kennedy is totally in the dark. But I do think that it is the duty of every mother, every loyal Christian, every person that regards the defense of this country as a sacred right, that they communicate not with their congressman, not with their senator, but with President Kennedy, and tell him, I do not think that you should send my boy or our boys wearing the uniform of the United States of America and under the flag that you see here, our red, white, and blue, to fight there to help keep in the hands of thieves that which they have stolen. I think everyone should not alone write once, but keep writing and get your friends to write. Now, I could go on endlessly and tell you these things to support what I have just asked you to do, but I don't think it's necessary to do that. You're above the average group in intelligence, and I don't think it's necessary to impress this anymore. But I want to tell you one more thing. You talk about, oh, the Jews. Why the Jews? Christianity. Why, we got Christianity from the Jews. And the Jews gave us Jesus, and the Jews gave us our religion. But do you know that on the Day of Atonement that you think is so sacred to them, that on that day, and I was one of them, this is not hearsay. I'm not here to be a rabble-rouser. I'm here to give you facts. When on the Day of Atonement you walk into a synagogue, the very first prayer that you recite, you stand, and it's the only prayer for which you stand, and you repeat three times a short prayer, the Kal Nidre. You enter into an agreement with God Almighty that any oath, vow, or pledge that you may make during the next 12 months, any oath, vow, or pledge that you may take during the next 12 months shall be null and void. The oath shall not be an oath. The vow shall not be a vow. the pledge shall not be a pledge, they shall have no force and effect, and so forth and so on. And further than that, the Talmud teaches, don't forget, whenever you take an oath, vow, and pledge, remember the Congregational Prayer that you recited on the Day of Atonement, and that exempts you from fulfilling that. How much can you depend upon their loyalty? You can depend upon their loyalty as much as the Germans depended upon it in 1916. And we're going to suffer the same fate that Germany suffered, and for the same reason. You can't depend upon something as insecure as the leadership that is not obliged to respect an oath, vow, or pledge. Now, I could go on and recite many other things to you, but I would have a little respect for your time, and you want to get through with all this. Tomorrow is going to be a long day. Now, I want to say one thing. You ask me, well, you think to yourself, well, how did this fellow get mixed up in this the way he got mixed up in it? Well, I opened my mouth in 1945, and I took big pages in newspapers and tried to tell the American people what I'm telling you. And one newspaper after another refused the advertisement. And when I couldn't find a newspaper to take them, I paid cash, not credit. What happened? My lawyer told me, well, there's an editor over in Jersey with a paper. He'll take your announcement. So I was brought together with Mr. McGinley, and that's how I met him. So somebody told me, the lawyer who introduced me, who was the son of the dean of the Methodist bishops, he said, well, I think he's a little anti-Semitic. I don't know whether I can get him over here. So we brought him over to my apartment, and we hit it off wonderfully and have since then. Now, I say this, and I say it without any qualification, I say it without any reservation, and I say it without any hesitation. If it wasn't for the work that Mr. Conde McGinley did with common sense, he's been sending out from 1,800,000 to 2 million every year. If it wasn't the work that he'd been doing, sending those out for 15 years now, we would already be a communist country. Nobody has done what he did to light fires. Many of the other active persons in this fight learned all about it for the first time through common sense. Now, I have been very active in helping him all I could. I'm not as flush as I was. I cannot go on spending the money. I'm not going to take up a collection, don't worry. I see five people getting up to leave. I haven't got the money that I used to spend. I used to print 250,000 of them out of my own pocket and send them out. Mr. McGinley, when I first met him, had maybe 5,000 printed and circulated them locally. So I said, with what you know and what I know, we can really do a good job. So I started printing in outside shops and big newspaper companies 250,000 and paid for them. Well, there's always a bottom to the barrel. I suppose we've all reached that time. Well, I'm not so poor that I can't live without working, and that's what worries the Anti-Defamation League. I can just get by without going and asking for a job or getting on the breadline. But Mr. McGinley is working, he's sick in bed, and he's going at this stronger than ever. And all I want to say is that they want to close up common sense more than any other single thing in the whole world as a death blow to the fight Christians are making to survive. So I want to just tell you this. All they do is circulate rumors. Mr. Benjamin H. Friedman, the wealthy backer of common sense. Well, the reason they do that is to discourage the people in the United States. Don't send any money to common sense. They don't need it. They've got the wealthy Mr. Friedman as a backer. That all has strategy. They don't want to advertise me so that people that have real estate or securities to sell will come and call on me They just want people to lay off common sense. And all I'm telling you is, I do try to help them, but I haven't been able to, and I'll be very honest. One thing I won't do is lie. In the last year, I've had so much sickness in my family that I could not give him $1. How he managed to survive, I don't know. God alone knows, and he must be in God's care, because how he pulled through with his sickness and with his financial troubles, I don't know. But that press is working, and every 2 weeks, about 100,000, 150,000 of common sense go out with a new message. And if that information could be multiplied, if people that now get it could buy 10 or 25 or 50, give them around, plow that field, sow those seeds. You don't know which will take root. But for God's sake, this is our last chance. And I know there are many other people in the field that are doing wonderful work. Mr. Goff, Mrs. Elizabeth Dilling, there are many, but none of them can say that they send out close to 2 million for 15 years. And at $1 a year. I've had almost fist fights with Mr. McGinley. Why don't you raise that to $3? How can he send out 24 at $1, and then when he gets a new subscriber, he'll give them $2 or $3 worth of circulars? And I would say that if there's one man that we want to keep into this fight, it's Conley McGinley. And rather than buy lipstick or cigarettes or whiskey, rather than bet on racehorses, go out and pay, I don't know what you call it, to play golf. You pay something to hit the ball, a tee fee or something. A green fee, thanks. I never played golf yet. I got a ball, so why chase after one? So anyhow, I'm telling you, if you want to make a sacrifice, if you want to make last year's slip do again, if you want to alter a dress to make it do again this year, if men, instead of going out and seeing a new necktie, you forego that necktie, keep poor Mr. McGinley, number one, alive. He's on his, maybe his deathbed. Nobody knows. He's very, very sick. Very sick. And number two, keep him in this fight. There is somebody here identified with that operation, so I wouldn't dare tell an untruth. I respect that person's confidence in me, but every day they owe more and more money to their creditors, and the time is going to come when they will be shut down, because there is no such animal as a wealthy Mr. Friedman to pick up the checks for them. That day is gone. I have my own responsibilities, and I'm glad to make both ends meet, and thank God for that. I will say that since 1933, I have spent of my lifetime's accumulations of hard work, according to the Department of Justice, who investigated me to convince themselves I wasn't an Arab propagandist receiving money from the Grand Mufti, I have spent $2,400,000+ that I accumulated through hard work. And I think it's time that a few of the other people picked up the check. And I will say, I found it very hard and very sad to do, because people said, why that Jew, why those Jew bastards, they're always the same, or goddamn Jew, you can't trust him, or what is he coming around here for, to go and report me to the Anti-Defamation League? And I had a tough time, so I said, fine all. I'm just working with Mr. McGinley. And I will admit that people who are in a position to assess my integrity, like Mr. Alan Zoll here and others, have all come around and said, some of them, in so many words, well, you have sure been a damn fool. I really threw myself into this fight, and I'm going to do it as long as the breath of life is left in me. And all I'm asking you all to do is buy one less pack of cigarettes a week. You ladies buy one less lipstick a month and keep common sense afloat. Because if it sinks, Christianity will sink with it. And mark my words, I hope it will never come to pass. But if you don't, you will see it come to pass. Now, is there anyone who would like to ask me a question? I'd like you to ask anything that's on your conscience, no matter what it is. All right, I'll comment on that. Now, I don't want to get into this question. It's rather deep, but you all have a very high degree of intelligence, so I'm going to make an attempt. In the time of Bible history, there was a geographic area known as Judea. Judea was a province of the Roman Empire. Now, a person who lived in Judea was known as a Judean, and in Latin it was Judaeus, and in Greek it was Judaios. Those are the two words, Greek and Latin, for a Judean. Now, the word in Latin and Greek, there is no such letter as J, and the first syllable of Judaeus and Judaios starts Jew. Now, when the Bible was written, it was first written in Greek, Latin, Canaantish, Syriac, Aramaic, all those languages. Never was the word Jew in any of them, because the word didn't exist. Judea was the country, and the people were Judeans, and Jesus was referred to only as a Judean. I have seen those earliest scripts available. I'm always at the American Bible Society, and there was no such thing. In 1345, a man by the name of Wycliffe in England thought it was time to translate the Bible into English. There was no English edition of the Bible, because who the devil could read? It was only the educated church people who could read Latin and Greek, Syriac, Aramaic, and the other languages. Anyhow, Wycliffe thought, I'm going to make this translation into English. And he did. But in it, he had to look around for some words for Judaeus and Judaeus. There was no English word because Judea had passed out of existence. There was no Judea. People had long ago forgotten that. So he, in the first translation, used a word in referring to Jesus as G-Y-U, Jew. The first translation of the Bible, of the scriptures into English, Jesus was referred to as G-Y-U, Jew. There was no printing press. Now, between 1345 and the 17th century, when the printing press came into use, that word passed through so many changes. I have them all here. If you want, I can read them to you. I will. That word, Jew, which was in the Wycliffe Bible, became it was first G-Y-U, Jew, then G-I-U, Jew, then I-U, Jew, because the I in Latin is pronounced like the J, like Julius Caesar is I-U-L. There is no J in Latin. Then I-U-W, Jew. Then I-E-U-U. Then I-E-U-I, Jewy. Then I-W-E. Then I-O-W. Then I-E-W-E. All in Bibles. As time went on, then I-E-U-E, then I-U-E, then I-V-E, then I-E-W, and finally, in the 18th century, J-E-W, Jew. All the corrupt and contracted form for Judaeus and Judaeus in Latin. Now, there was no such thing as Jew, and any theologian, I've lectured in maybe 20 of the most prominent theological seminaries in this country, and two in Europe, there was no such word as Jew. There only was Judea, and Jesus was a Judean. And the first English use of a word in an English Bible to describe him was G-Y-U, Jew, a contracted and shortened form of Judaeus. Just the same as we call a lab for laboratory, and we call a pram for a perambulator, and gas for gasoline. There's a tendency to shorten up. So who in England knew, if you put out in spelling Judaeus or Judaeus, the English, there were no public schools, people didn't know how to read it. They wouldn't know what it was. It looked like a scrambled alphabet. So they made a short word out of it. Like in England, they call a public house, which is a bar in our country, a pub. Easy to remember and simple. Now, for a theologian to say that you can't harm the Jews is just ridiculous, because I'd like to know where in the scriptures it says that. I'd like to know the text. But now they say in Germany, look at what happened to Germany for touching the Jews. What would you, as a citizen of the United States, do to people that did to you what the so-called Jews, the Polaks and Litvaks and Galicianers, they weren't Jews, as I just explained to you. They were Eastern Europeans who'd been converted to Talmudism. There was no such a thing as Judaism. Judaism was a name given in recent years to this religion known in Bible history as Torah Piyava. No Jew or no educated person ever heard of Judaism. It didn't exist. They pulled it out of the air, a meaningless word, just like anti-Semitic. The Arabs are the Semites, and the Christians go around talking about people who don't like Jews as anti-Semites, and they call all the Arabs anti-Semites. The only Semites in the world are the Arabs. There isn't one Jew who's a Semite. They're all Turco-Finn Mongoloids, the Eastern European Jews. So they brainwash the public, and if you will invite me to meet this reverend who told you these things, I'll convince him, and it'll be one step in the right direction, and I'll go wherever I have to go to meet him. Yes, ma'am. Well, I can answer that. First of all, your first premise is wrong. Your first premise is wrong, that all the Jews are loyal to each other. Because the Eastern European Jews outnumber all the rest by so many that they create the impression that they are the Jewish race, that they are the Jewish nation, that they are the Jewish people, and the Christians swallow it like a cream puff. But in 1844, the German rabbis called a conference of rabbis from all over the world for the purpose of abolishing the Kal Nidre from the Day of Atonement religious ceremony. And they called in all these rabbis. And in Brunswick, Germany, where that was held in 1844, there was almost a terrific riot, a civil war, while the Eastern Europeans said, what the hell? We should give up Kal Nidre? That gives us our grip on our people. We give them a franchise so that they can tell the Christians, go to hell, we'll make any deal you want, but they don't have to carry it out. That gives us our grip on our people. So they're not so united. And if you knew the feeling that exists, now I'll also show you from an official document by the man responsible for... We baptized this place. That here is here is a paper that we obtained from the archives of the Zionist organization in New York City, and in it is the manuscript by Sir James A. Malcolm, who, on behalf of the British cabinet, negotiated the deal with the Zionists. And in here he says that all the Jews in England were against it. The Jews that had been there for years, the Sephardic, those that had Portuguese and Spanish and Dutch ancestry, who were monotheists and believed in that religious belief, while these Eastern European Jews were still running around in the heart of Asia. And then they came into Europe. But they had no more to do with them than, can you talk about a Christian race or a Christian religion? Or are the Christians united? Well, the same disunity exists amongst the Jews. And I'll show you in this same document that when they went to France to try and get the French government to back that Zionist adventure, there was only one Jew in France who was for it. That was Rothschild. And they did it because they were interested in the oil and the Suez Canal.
Well, I know that.
Do you know why? Do you know why? Because if they don't, they're dead ducks. They come around and they tell you how much you must give. And if you don't, oh, you're anti-Semitic. Then none of their friends will have anything to do with them. And they start a smear campaign, and you've got to give. In New York City, in the Garment Center, there are 12 manufacturers in the building, and when the drive is on to sell Israel bombs, the United Jewish drive, they put a big scoreboard with the names of the firms, and opposite them, as you make the amount they put you down for, they put a gold star. And the buyers are told, when you come into that building to call on someone, and they haven't got a gold star, go up and tell them you won't buy from them until they have a gold star. Blackmail. I don't know what else you can call it. Then what do they do? They tell you it's for humanitarian purposes, and they've sent maybe $8 billion to Israel, tax exempt, tax deductible. So if they hadn't sent that $8 billion to Israel, $7 billion of it would have gone into the United States Treasury as income tax. So what happened? That $7 billion deficit, that air pocket, the dumb Christians have to make up. They put a bigger tax on gas or bread or corporation tax. Somebody has to pay the housekeeping expenses for the government. So why do you let these people send their money over there to buy guns, to drive people out of their ancient homeland, and you say, oh, well, the poor Jews, they have no place to go, and they're persecuted all their life. They've never been persecuted for religion. And I wish I had two rows of rabbis here to challenge me. Never once in all history have they been persecuted for their religion. You know why the Jews were driven out of England? You know they were, in Edward the First. 1285, and they never came back until the Cromwell Revolution, which was financed by the Rothschilds. For 400 years, there wasn't a Jew. But do you know why they were driven out of? Because in the Christian faith and the Muslim faith, it's a sin to charge rent for the use of money. In other words, what we call interest is a sin. So the Jews had a monopoly in England, and they charged so much interest, and when the lords and dukes couldn't pay, they foreclosed. And they were creating so much trouble that the King of England finally made himself their partner, because when they came to foreclose, some of these dukes bumped off the Jews, the moneylenders. So the king finally said, and this is all in history, look up Hyamson or Rorke, The History of the Jews in England, two books you can find in your library, that when the king found out what this trouble was all about, and he found out how much money they were making, he declared himself a 50% partner of the moneylenders, Edward the First. And for many years, one-third of the revenue of the British Treasury came from the 50% interest in moneylending by the Jews. But it got worse and worse, so much worse, that
They kept up this idea of bumping off the moneylenders, and then the King of England said, well, I declare myself the heir of all the moneylenders. If they're bumped off, you've got to pay me. I'm his sole heir. So that made so much trouble because the king had to go out and collect it with an army that he told the Jews, get the hell out of here. And he gave every Jew, there were 15,000 of them, they had to get out, and they went across to Ireland. And that's how Ireland got into the United Kingdom. When King Edward found out what they were doing, he said, well, if anybody takes that nice island over there, I'm going to take it for myself. And he sent Robert Southguard with a mercenary army and conquered Ireland. So show me one time. There is no case in all history that I know about where a Jew was persecuted in any country because he went home and put on those things, the Tolleson Trillum, and said, Shema Yisrael, instead of going into a church and saying, Our Father in Heaven. Not once. It's always their impact on the political, social, or economic customs and traditions of the community in which they settle. Now, somebody back there wants to answer. Yes, sir.
I have my hand ready.
Well, they say most of those things themselves. It was unnecessary for Benjamin Franklin to say it. Most of those things they say themselves. But now let me tell you, Benjamin Franklin observed and by hearsay understood what was happening in Europe. When Russia in 920 was formed and gradually surrounded the Khazar kingdom and then absorbed them, most of the well-to-do Khazars fled to Western Europe and brought with them the very things to which you object and I object and a lot of other people object. The customs, the habits, the instincts with which they were endowed. Now, Benjamin Franklin referred to them as Jews because that's the name that they went by. That's the name that they took. And the Christians, when they first heard that these people that were fleeing from Russia, who they were, that they had practiced this Talmudic faith, the Christians in Western Europe said, they must be the remnants of the lost 10 tribes. And Mr. Gretz, the greatest historian amongst the Jews, says that. And he's probably as good an authority on that subject as there is. So that when Benjamin Franklin came to Europe, in let's say the 18th century, he already saw the result of what these people had done after they left their homeland. And every word of it is gospel. Every word of it. And they themselves say it. I can give you a half a dozen books that they've written in which they say that. That when they have money, they become tyrants, and when they become defeated, they become ruthless. They state it. They're only barbarians. They're the descendants of Asiatic Mongols, and they will do anything to accomplish their purpose. What right did they have to do? What right did they have to take over Russia the way they did? The Tsar had abdicated 10 months before that, or 9 months before that. There was no need for them. They were going to have a constitutional monarchy. But they didn't want that. And so when the constitutional monarchy was to assemble in November, they mowed them all down and established the Soviet Union. There was no need for that. But they thought, now is the time. And if you will look in the Encyclopedia Britannica under the word Bolshevism, you will find the five laws there that Lenin puts down for a successful revolution. And one of them is, wait for the right time, and then give them everything you've got. It would pay you to read that. You'd also find that Mr. Harold Lasky, who wrote the article for the Encyclopedia Britannica, states that the Jews conceived and created and cultivated the communist movement, and that their energy made them the spearhead of the movement. Harold Lasky wrote it, and no one knew more about communism than he, and the Encyclopedia Britannica for 25 years has been printing it. What more do you want? Anybody else? Well, I can't advocate that you do anything that's criminal or that might get your boys into trouble, but I can tell you this, that you can start what I call an endless chain. If you can get your friends to write, objecting to it. Here is the statement. Mr. Kennedy's office gave me this himself. Mr. Smith, who succeeded Mr. Kennedy, took over his office, was in his office and gave me this for release to AM, that means morning papers, August 26th. He delivered this on the 25th. And it says here, Israel is here to stay. That Israel is here to stay. It is a national commitment, special obligation on the Democratic Party. The White House must take the lead. American intervention. We will act promptly and decisively against any nation in the Middle East which attacks its neighbor. I propose that we make clear to both Israel and the Arab states our guarantee that we will act with whatever force and speed are necessary to halt any aggression by any nation. Well, do you call the return of people to their homeland aggression? Is Mr. Kennedy going to do that? Suppose 3 million Mexicans came into Texas and drove the 6 million Texans into the deserts of Arizona and New Mexico. Suppose these Mexicans were slipped in there, armed, the Texans are disarmed, and one night they drove them all out of Texas and they declared themselves the Republic of the Alamo. What would the United States say? Would we say it's aggression for these Texans to try to get their homes back from these Mexican thieves? Suppose the Negroes in Alabama were secretly armed by the Soviets, and overnight they rose up and drove all the whites into the swamps of Mississippi and Georgia and Florida. Drove them out completely, and they declared themselves the Republic of Ham or the Republic of something or other. Would we call it aggression if these people, the whites of Alabama, tried to go back to their homes? What would we think if the Soviet Union said, no, those Negroes now occupy them, let them there? Or if the Soviet Union said, no, those Mexicans are in Texas, they declared themselves a sovereign state, leave them there. You have plenty of room in Utah and Nevada. Settle them elsewhere. Would we call it aggression if the Alabama whites or the Texans wanted to go back to their homes? So now you've got to write to President Kennedy and say, we do not consider it aggression in the sense that you use the word. If these people want to return to their homes as United Nations, 15 times in the last 12 years called upon the Zionists in occupation of Palestine to allow these people to return to their former homes and farms. Now, I'm sure that Kennedy is smart, and when he used the word aggression, he may have had in the back of his mind, well, maybe I can get out of this. You can't call it aggression if people merely want to get back to their homes.
You have just heard an address by Benjamin H. Friedman, World Authority on the Communist Conspiracy and its treasonous aims to unleash the United States into a Third World War.